Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library.
No mai, haere mai, kia ora. Welcome to Books and Beyond. This is your host, Alison, and today I'm joined in the studio by Karen. Kia ora, Karen.
Kia ora, Alison. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. Look, thanks for tuning in, everyone. Our show today is a continuation of the New Year's resolution theme, because after all, it is still January. And Karen and I have been thinking of how we would both like to be this year and who we would most like to emulate. So we thought we would take some inspiration from some of our favourite books. And we're going to start with Little Women.
I wonder why. Is it possibly because we've both just been to see the movie?
Yeah, that's right.
The new movie.
Now, as kids, many of us had to play that game, which daughter do you see yourselves as? So I know who I saw myself as a kid, but you know, I actually loved the whole of the March family, and I still do. They were abolitionists who were committed to social change, and they valued virtue over wealth. I like that. And they practiced radical kindness way before it became fashionable and had its own hashtag.
I'm clearly very unfashionable, Alison, because I did not even know that it had its own hashtag.
Oh, right, it does now. Yeah. But when I was growing up, I really wanted to be like Jo March, but I probably didn't have the fiery temper that she displayed, but I always loved her tomboy aspect.
I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah, go figure.
Now, in my family, unfortunately, we didn't actually all get to choose. So we did have three sisters in the family. A marriage made in heaven with which March family are you? But my oldest sister, who did have a very fiery temper, insisted on choosing the parts, and she got to be Jo. And she insisted that I be Amy. And I didn't actually particularly want to be Amy, but I don't remember it as traumatic. It might have been if I'd already seen this version, because I did think that the unlikability of Amy was particularly stressed in this version.
Yeah, because this is the seventh adaptation, I do believe. But, you know, when I was growing up, my brother never really wanted to play this game with me. He didn't want to choose which character he'd like to be. But he could have been Laurie.
Oh, yeah, perhaps. He could have, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
As for the film itself, well, you were saying that you were a little bit annoyed with it, weren't you? You know, about the feminist message?
Well, yes, that's I hope nobody takes that badly. You popped that right out in the first sentence in such a... That was a very, it's a bit more complicated than that. So, I loved the film. I actually really loved it. I really enjoyed seeing it. And it was interesting. It was a very womanly film, not in a negative way of womanly, but in that way of it being warm and loving and beautiful. Not womanly, like, you know, you have to cook dinner every night. But I was a little annoyed the way, as you said, it really hit us over the head with the feminist message, sort of implying that the story in itself was not enough for us to glean the feminist message that Alcott was including in her book. And I remember reading in the reviews of the movie when it came out that Patti Smith was quoted as saying that, of course, it was one of her favorite books when she was growing up. And she was a Jo when she played, which March sister are you?
Yeah, of course.
And she called it a maverick girl. She said that Jo was there for the maverick girls like myself, and talked about tossing her cropped hair and winking. Didn't Jo whistle? I'm sure that...
Yes,
isn't there a scene?
Yes.
It wasn't in the movie where Jo also whistles and Meg gets angry at her for whistling. So I think I'm a bit sad that the movie... I'm regretful that the movie didn't think that people could appreciate those things on their own without changing the story so radically as, for instance, to say that Jo opened a school for girls. Jo didn't. She opened a school for boys. Mm-hmm. Nobody would have sent their daughter to a school for girls, except, of course, Meg, her sister, mother of Daisy, who, in fact, was the only girl in Jo's school for boys.
Yeah, I agree. And it's unfortunate because I do think also that it was just a little bit heavy-handed like that. But, you know, this is like so much that comes out of Hollywood. And I really wish they wouldn't do that to us. You know, as an aside, one of my favourite TV series at the moment is Madam Secretary. But instead of letting the powerful scenes just sort of sit with the viewer, it's like they use a metaphorical building site tool, like a shovel, and they dump the meaning all over you. But, you know, in the case of Little Women, I was prepared to overlook this sort of clumsiness and just really love the film.
Well, it sounds like speaking about a relationship, which in effect is what we all have with Little Women. You and I have, and many women do. I did like, I have to say, the emphasis on Marmee's frustration and anger, because I identified a lot with that in my growing up, realizing what a the bad spin of the dice my mother had had compared to me. You know, what we realized about our mothers as we were growing up, about how many constraints had been on them. And I think I realized my mother had always wanted to be a doctor, but she studied business in school. You know?
Yeah.
And I really, really liked the non-linear timeline and the metafiction. So in particular, and this was a great inspiration on the part of Greta Gerwig, was the metafiction where Jo is bringing out her novel. She's at the publisher's, and the publisher says, and she has to end it with the heroine getting married, even though she, Louisa May Alcott, never got married. And so then they show us, you know, the happy love scene totally invented with Frederick. And I don't think any other movie version of Little Women, I haven't seen all seven, had showed us this fact that the author of the book was a spinster.
Yeah, that's right.
I think my favorite Jo is still, I have to say, though, Katharine Hepburn.
Yes.
Talk about being a spinster. More the way I imagined her, more spinster-like, with the high cheekbones and the red hair and the sharp tongue. And Saoirse, I thought, had a little bit of the Botticelli goddess about her. What did you think about the casting?
Yeah, I loved Saoirse in this role, because I think she's really something
absolutely.
As an actor.
Very fine actor, yes.
Yeah, and I really loved Laura Dern as the character Marmee. I thought she was just gorgeous in that. But really, Katharine Hepburn is always going to be one of my idols.
And rightly so.
Yeah.
I also, interestingly, never imagined Laurie as being kind of dopey the way that Timothée Chalamet played him. I actually thought, when I saw the poster, you're going to die when you hear this. I wish the audience could see your face. When I first saw the poster, when the movie just came out, I knew nothing about the casting. I knew nothing about it except it was a new Little Women movie. They had Saoirse to one side, large, full figure, and then four faces down the side, and it was Laurie and the three other sisters. And I looked at the poster and I said, oh my God, this really is a new Little Women. They've made it, one of the Little Women is transgender. I thought... Yeah. I thought Saoirse was the mother, and those were the four girls, and one of them was Timothée Chalamet.
That would have been just awesome, wouldn't it? So, I mean, maybe that's what we have to look forward to.
In the eighth version
the
of
eighth,
Little Women.
Iteration of it. Yeah. Well, and then other thoughts about Little Women. I know that it's been criticised by some people for being so white. You know, that sort of unbearable whiteness of being. But I'd really push back on that theory somewhat, because I think it's important that we remember that the book it's not presented as being the only feminist worldview, or indeed the most important one. And it's describing the worldview of a white family in Massachusetts during the Civil War, who lived in genteel poverty and worked to right injustice and be kind to others. So I don't think that Louisa May Alcott was trying to speak for all women as a universal voice. What do you think, Karen?
Well, I think it's autofiction, and I don't think that Alcott did mean it to be a universal story. It's not. It's her story. And inserting black characters now into the movie would not make it universal. That makes it what we call representational. So I thought it was great the producers included the black women among the women. You remember when Marmee's helping the soldiers make their way back home?
Yes.
And there's a freed black woman working among them. I'm trying to think what more they could do. You know, there was a non-linear timeline, but I don't think they could have had Amy in Paris meeting a black man in Paris, but I was thinking they could have had her possibly just squeeze in a meeting with a very old Alexandre Dumas, who was the grandson of a black servant.
Or she could have squeezed in a meeting of a really, really, really young James Baldwin.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Yes.
I think the real problem of today is that a film about a white person gets touted as a universal story.
Yeah.
And the film of Beloved or The Color Purple does not. And this is the problem. None of these are universal stories if you're going by plot, but if you're going by themes, love, loss, growing up, sorrow, then they all are equally.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it there, to use a building site metaphor.
I wondered if the tool you were going to talk about was going to be a hammer. I thought it was going to be a hammer and then it was a shovel.
But look, let's move on to some of our other favourite characters. And if we travel from the northeast down to the southern states of America, I loved the book Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe. And so I really want to be headstrong and brave like Edgy Threadgood. I just loved her tomboyishness. Gee, that's a difficult word to say. But that tomboy aspect, it's also a recurring theme for me, isn't it, Karen? Go figure. But, you know, I loved Itchy's ability to feel joy at, you know, the simplest of activities, like skimming stones in puddles. And I loved how she'd get her clothes really dirty and how she refused to wear a pretty dress to a family wedding. And there was a great family drama over that. And I admired her when she established the Whistle Stop Cafe with her friend Ruth. And then I cheered when she stood up to the hateful members of the Ku Klux Klan. And then when she took such a brave stand to protect Ruth from family violence. And I know that she carried such immense grief with her, but I felt I was carrying that grief along with the character. Also, absolutely loved the film when I saw it in 1991. And it was somewhat of a coming-of-age film for the characters and for myself, I think.
Well, it sounds like... who's the author?
Fanny Flagg.
Oh, Fanny Flagg,
yes,
of course.
I nearly forgot.
I was thinking Fanny, another Fanny that was a political figure. So, it's interesting because a lot of things with the What March Sister Are You, in real life, you've got a bit of one March Sister and a bit of the other, don't you? Most people. And I think it was interesting when you said skimming stones, because that was the one scene in the movie of Little Women where we saw Meg do something brawny, remember she skims the stone and she does it very well? Can't remember if they have her actually doing it better than her beau, but anyway, she skims the stone. So who was in the movie, speaking of movies?
Mary Stuart Masterton was one of the characters. Lots of well-known characters. Another
well-known actresses.
Well-known actors.
It's allowed.
It had a good cast.
Yeah, I really have to read the. I'll have to read the book before I see the movie. Maybe while I'm waiting for my copy of Where the Crawdads Sing. I feel like they must be kin. These two books. So I know Crawdads has a mystery and a coming of age, a romance. Is there a murder mystery in Fried Green Tomatoes? Oh, there is.
Actually, I forgot to mention that. And a big murder mystery. Yeah, so quite similar. Do you know? I must warn you though that. For you, I think you might find Fried Green Tomatoes a little bit on the folksy side, so I think you'd need to be prepared for that. No, you look horrified.
Well, I can't believe I look like somebody who would snob a book because it's on the folksy side.
Oh, sorry.
I didn't mean to. I must project a sort of a highbrow thing here. So I want to put out there, I'm ready for anything, at least in reading, and I think that's actually the reason why the first character I chose when you said let's pick characters that we admire or want to be like or emulate was the first one that came to my mind was Logan Mountstuart in William Boyd's book Any Human Heart. In the line, my line for this is, I want to continue to be a romantic all my life, even if a doomed romantic. Not sure about if a folksy romantic. But Logan Mountstuart was not folksy. He was actually the son of an upper class. Upper class father, and his mother was from Uruguay. But what was she? She was something else. She was not upper class, or maybe she was, but not in England. Anyway, so I was trying to remember because his middle name, I think it's Gonzago. Logan Gonzago Mountstuart, because in fact, so the book is the form of a journal, is written in the form of Logan Mountstuart's journal, and then there are little connective pieces of narrative when you have to, when one journal breaks off and another one starts, and he's constantly, the narrator calls him LMS, continuing our
DFW and the DUM. That's our tradition, isn't
our
it?
Tradition. So when I was trying to remember the middle name, I was thinking, oh, I should have a look, but I actually was too busy looking at another thing, which I thought was really shocking, which was that when I did Google the name to see if it was Gonzago, which I still don't know, because I was carried away by a newspaper story that came up in the Daily Mail about a British game show host who was applying for resource consent, and he wanted to use a fake name, and he chose Logan Mountstuart, for assuming that nobody in his city council would have read William Boyd. And the journalist in the Daily Mail described him, so not the game show host, but Logan Mountstuart, as a boozy love cheat.
That's a great headline, isn't it, for the Daily Mail?
It may be a perfect headline for the Daily Mail, but it is not what Logan Mountstuart is. Logan Mountstuart is not a boozy love cheat. He's a bit boozy, but he's not a love cheat. And what is a love cheat anyway? If you took love cheats out of literature, what would you have left?
We'd have nothing to read.
25% of the books.
Yes.
So he falls in love with someone who is not the woman he is married to. And as often in England of those days, if you were upper class and you got married, it was to an affable woman who had the right amount of independent fortune. Am I correct?
Yes.
Not necessarily the love of your life. And so back to Daily Mail, I would like to quote to the Daily Mail the epigraph of the book, which is where the title comes from. It's a line from Henry James, and it is, "Never say you know the last word about any human heart."
Gee, isn't that good advice?
Yeah,
advice for life.
It's absolutely, the book is full of good advice. And I'm trying to think, what was the other? Oh, yeah. So I was going to say that an example of being ready to take anything that life throws at you, which is the sort of the credo of Logan Mountstuart, LGS. LGM, excuse me. Did I say LMS? LGS before? No, LGM. Logan Gonzago Mountstuart. Is that he, so to show how he takes everything that life throws at him with humor and dignity, when he is so poor that he's reduced to selling revolutionary newspapers in London and living on dog meat, he experiments and he finds just the right brand that if you add a pinch of curry, it makes all the difference.
I'll have to remember that if I ever have to eat dog food.
Yes,
yeah,
that's right.
I hope it doesn't happen, but...
Yeah, you never know, because as Logan says, every life is both ordinary and extraordinary. And, you know, his thing is that the great love is what has made his life worth it, and you just don't give up. So he actually has a funny little part where he talks about people giving up, and he mentions that Evelyn Waugh and T.S. Eliot supposedly both gave up, could no longer find the inspiration to write when they had their teeth extracted and they were presented with a pair of snappers. Oh. And he said maybe that's the fear that paralyzes aging authors, that they might have lost their bite.
Oh dear, I have that fear as well somehow.
Yes. Are you serious? Way too young.
Well, thank you. Now, in contrast to the romantics among us, I've got a huge crush on a cool, calm and collected and calculating hero from the Millennium series of books. And I'm speaking of the Dragon Tattoo trilogy. So I want to be brave and feisty and super intelligent like Lisbeth Salander. I love how she breaks all the rules in order to do what is right. She's a survivor of immense trauma, and she uses her intelligence and physical prowess to do good, to right wrongs and catch baddies. You know, she's a badass, I would say, as opposed to a bad boy. She rides her motorbike like a demon, and she has the martial arts skills of a master, someone with sort of an infinite degree black belt.
I didn't know. Is martial arts something you do?
Well, yes, yeah. Although I'm terrible at combat martial arts, I must admit, that's where I don't fit her profile. But I do Tai Chi. And
I think that counts as an ID point with Lisbeth.
Yeah, well, I have my black belt, and we do quite a bit of combat and self-defense, but that's the part I'm not good at.
Which is why you pick all the characters who are brave.
Yes, the brave, yeah, and the ones that are sort of kick-ass characters. Yeah, so now these have been made into films as well.
The Millennium series.
Yes, yeah. But there have been about four different Lisbeth Salanders, and I've liked all of them except Claire Foy, who's the English actress who played, played Lisbeth. And I really feel that she was hopelessly miscast in that. She was too gentle. But I hope that's not too negative.
I was sitting here clapping silently at how brave you were.
Yeah, very brave.
Yeah. So I've got a brave one for you. I mean, it's mine, but you can share it with me. And it's Madeline.
Oh, yes.
In an old house in Paris that was covered with vines, lived 12 little girls in two straight lines.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes. So Brave Madeline is the one that the other couplet, well, actually not a couplet, two couplets, she was not afraid of mice. She loved winter, snow, and ice. To the tigers in the zoo, Madeline just said, poo, poo.
Oh, yes. You go, girl.
Yeah. And vas-y, mon enfant.
Oh, yeah.
But she was really, Madeline was really the start of my love affair with France. Like all characters you fall in love with, it's not just them. It's the setting. It's a million other things. The feeling. And that scene, there's a scene. So this is a picture book, a children's picture book, for anyone who doesn't know. And there's in his hand, it's drawn by the same man, Ludwig Bemelmans, who wrote the picture book. And these beautiful drawings of Paris seen through the eyes of children. Well, a mix. You know, it's that wonderful way of illustrating children's books where you get the grown-up savoir-faire, but you get what impresses the child the most. There's a scene when they're looking for the dog that the board of the orphanage has kicked out of the orphanage their adopted dog, and they go searching all night through the dog, and there's scenes where they're walking through the gardens where there's a little boy buying a red balloon from the balloon man, and then through the cafe, the existentialist cafes with bearded people sitting at them, and then at Père Lachaise Cemetery among the graves.
Yeah, and all the dogs and where people look like their dogs, don't
they? Yes, did you remember that too?
Yeah,
just the guy with a bulldog face sitting next to his bulldog, and then there's like a woman with a poodle, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and the hat. I loved the hats that the schoolgirls wear.
The big yellow hats.
Yeah.
It's funny you should say that, because I once saw on a Halloween costume website a thing saying, you can be Madeline, just get yourself a yellow hat. And then they showed this woman wearing a big kind of 1970s hippie floppy yellow hat and a blue dress. And then she was wearing this slinky blue dress because, of course, people who go to Halloween parties don't want to really look like a kid. And I'm just going to put out there, don't do it. You know, Madeline did not wear a slinky blue dress. She wore a blue cape, like you do when you're in an orphanage, navy blue cape.
So it's, I think, good advice. Don't do that. Just don't do that.
Yeah, imitate the character like we're doing in your mind and in your actions, not by dressing up like.
Yeah, that's something wrong with that. Now, speaking of hats, I would really like to be like the cat in The Cat in the Hat, because he's such a cheerful anarchist, actually. He's like the most fun uncle that you could ever possibly have. He pushes boundaries constantly, but ultimately he does keep the children safe. And I loved how he brought in that, you know, that super vacuum cleaning machine at the last minute, and he has the house clean just as the mother walks in the door.
Yeah, kid's dream, isn't
it? Yeah, and, you know, I was thinking every teenager's dream, if you've ever thrown a party when mum and dad didn't know. So you need that machine. But what I like about him, he's really like the anti-Mary Poppins.
That's
true.
I
thought that was cool. That was why I liked him so much. And I was thinking, you know, my nephews regard me as a pretty fun auntie, but I'm going to need to push myself a bit to reach the fun heights of Mr. Cat in the Hat.
I see it. I think you can strive for that one. So I've got one of my most admired and beloved characters, as you're saying, beloved of Cat in the Hat, is Charlotte Cavatica, Charlotte A. Cavatica. And this would be Charlotte the Spider, who's Ben's Charlotte's Web. as Wilbur refers to her, a loyal and gifted friend. And then the last lines of the book, I've got to say these out loud, a salute to Charlotte. Wilbur never forgot Charlotte. So Charlotte's died. Wilbur goes back to live on the farm all these days. He'll never be butchered because Charlotte has saved him with her messages and her web. And he says, Wilbur never forgot Charlotte. Although he loved her children and grandchildren dearly, none of the new spiders ever quite took her place in his heart. She was in a class by herself. It is not often that someone comes along who is a true friend and a good writer. Charlotte was both.
Oh, that's so sad.
That was where I threw myself on the bed and sobbed when I read it.
Oh, dear. Yes. Oh, I hate it when the animal dies.
The animal dies is the whole cathartica. You know, yes. Charlotte Cavatica is also Charlotte cathartica. A big sob after reading a great book. I think it's one of the most soul-reviving things you can have. Yes. Charlotte is mythic, to use the modern word, at the time was not used for this kind of thing. Charlotte was mythic.
Yeah, well, look, speaking of myth, I've got a New Zealand character that I want to be like this year and for the rest of my life. I want to be a brave and a strong yet gentle leader like Pikeya in The Whale Rider. So Pikeya challenges tradition and embraces the past in order to find that strength to lead her people forward. And she has such sadness in her life, and it's really heartbreaking. And yet she overcomes these really massive obstacles to lead and ultimately save her people. Do you know, I'll never forget the scene in the movie where Pikeya is giving that speech at her school, and it's about her ancestor, Pikeya, and she dedicates the speech to her koro, and she speaks of her sense of failure as a leader. So in the film, Keisha Castle-Hughes gave such a strong performance here, and I remember sobbing in the movie when I first saw this scene, just like the ending of Charlotte's Web, actually.
Oh yeah, I remember sobbing too, and as I recall, when I saw it in the theater, which was actually in California in the movie theater, everybody was sobbing.
Yeah.
Not sure if Californians just sob more.
It's a universally sob-inducing scene, isn't it? I watched it on YouTube again last night, just that clip, and it still brings big tears to my eyes. And I can really see why she was nominated for an Academy Award for this role. Just such a powerful actor.
Well, I can use that. Congratulations myself. I totally agree. Keisha was absolutely fantastic in that movie. But I'm also going to say, when you said so powerful, because I remembered one more character, and I can put it in. It takes us back to the northeast of the United States.
Full circle.
Exactly. Which is Olive Kitteridge. So Olive Kitteridge fans, these are two books by Elizabeth Stroud, will know that there is a brand new Olive Kitteridge book came out last year. And Olive Kitteridge is strong, severe, but above all, I think, highly original character. My love with Olive Kitteridge is a bit of a flirtation, so she does things that I don't dare do, and she admits openly to hating the same kinds of things that I hate, encouraging me to be allowed to enjoy hating them. So, for instance, people trying to get you to collude in some activity that you don't actually want to collude in, or just annoying, useless things that you want things to have a purpose, and that you don't have to anymore because you're grown up. And what you really hate is when they don't acknowledge that you're grown up. And the great thing about Olive is that this is the thing. She prizes truth and honesty, which I say, what's the point of growing up? You have to put up with a lot of things in growing old. But if you don't earn the right to have the truth and be honest, you know, this is the big prize that you get. Isn't there some book where they talk about that?
But isn't it, that's one of the benefits of being a grown up, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, yay. That's wonderful. I love Olive. I want to be her as well. So look, just a reminder that the books mentioned today are listed on our show notes, which you'll find through our websites. So look, until next time, happy reading, haere rā, and ka kite anō.
Haere rā, Alison, and to all our listeners. This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz, and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM.
or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond.
Every day, every day, every day, every day, every day.